I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, what do the eerily synchronistic Baron Trump novels of 19th century author Ingersoll Lockwood, the media theories of Marshall McLuhan, ancient history, and classic films like David Cronenberg's Videodrome, and the Jim Carrey vehicle, The Truman Show, all have in common? Well, returning guest and media theorist, John David Ebert, argues that they are all part of what he calls hyper-modernity. John has just released a new book, co-authored with Brian Francis Culkin, entitled Hyper-Modernity and the End of the World. Joining John on this edition of the show is poet Michael Kamens, who authored the preface to Hypermodernity and the End of the World. This conversation, this trialogue, is, what can I say, a wild, wild ride for listeners, and an extra long conversation, clocking in at over 2 hours and spanning a variety of topics. Whether it's the parallels between Trumpism and Caesarism, or 9/11 as what John refers to as America's Hyksos event. You may be asking what that is. You'll have to learn about it in the conversation. Without further ado, this special over 2 hour trialogue with media theorist John David Ebert and poet Michael Kamens on hypermodernity and the end of the world. Welcome to Parallax Views, John David Ebert, a returning guest, and along with him, Michael Aaron Kamens.
Thank you for having us, JG.
Yeah, thank you.
So, John, you have a new book out co-authored with Brian Francis Culkin entitled Hypermodernity and the End of the World?
The End of the World, that's right.
The End of the World, yes. And Michael has written the preface for that. Michael, maybe you could introduce yourself for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with you. I know John's already done an episode with us that's actually one of my most popular episodes, so Maybe if you want to introduce yourself, and then John can tell listeners that didn't hear our last episode together a little bit about himself as well.
Yeah, sure. I'm a poet. My background is in the literary arts, and I also studied depth psychology, which is, you know, Jung and Freud, and I kind of consider myself an archetypal psychologist to the degree that I'm very interested in images and the history of images. One thing that me and John have in common, and that was one of the reasons why I reached out to him maybe 7 years ago or so, is that we have a similar background in myth studies and an interest in archetypal images and Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung and stuff like that. But I've always been really devoted to poetry. When I was an adolescent, in grammar school, I wanted to be a sci-fi writer. I wanted to write science fiction. But then in adolescence, I discovered rock music and I read Dylan Thomas for the first time. And that just changed me. And I became really interested in this idea that our experience of reality is mediated by language. And I became interested in experimenting with that, with language. If you could sort of play with language, then you could sort of transform reality.
Do you sort of mean what people like, say, William S. Burroughs or Tristan Zara were doing with sort of cut-up poetry and using the cut-up method, or do you mean something else with regards to language?
I think that's one thing. I mean, I think that's one way of looking at it, that's one method for experimenting with language that can change your experience of reality, change your perception. The story kind of goes for me is that when I reached out to John, I was in this dry spell with poetry, and I kind of felt like maybe it was something that I had outgrown, and there was just nothing new that I could do with it. And when I reached out to John, he was just starting to write The New Media Invasion, and he was looking into Jean Baudrillard and Paul Virilio and starting to do videos on contemporary philosophy and postmodern philosophy. And it was really listening to those videos at first. I remember John did a video on Derrida's Structure, Sign, and Play. And that video and also his one of his early videos on Deleuze and Guattari's A Thousand Plateaus really changed something in me. And when I heard him talking about with the absence of a transcendental signifier, that Derrida talks about, that language can sort of slip and slide. And many people sort of lament that perspective, because it means that it sort of lends itself to relativism in different spheres. But as a poet, I saw that as really liberating, and I set out to kind of construct my own self-referential system of signs, so my own kind of poetic language, and that wasn't constrained to anything except my own conceptual universe and this idea that words could also have, because words are referential and aren't anchored to anything transcendent, that there was this endless iteration that could occur. So you could pack in multiple allusions into words. And so that stuff really blew my mind, and that led me to my first published book of poetry, Absences, which John basically turned me on to all these postmodern authors, and kind of got me on this path of rediscovering myself as a poet.
So I'm John David Ebert, and I'm a cultural critic. And I've been doing cultural criticism now for, it seems like forever, but I published my first book when I was 30 years old. And I came out of a background, like Michael was talking about with his career, in myth studies. I started out as a Joseph Campbell scholar. I came out of, right out of college, I got a four-year degree in English, a BA in English. And I came out after reading his books, deciding that I didn't want to go back for any higher degrees because I knew that they would not let me roam wherever I wanted to go. I knew they would want me to specialize in something. And at that point, I didn't want to specialize. I wanted the big picture. So I didn't go back. And for a year or two, I wandered around aimlessly, going from job to job to job. And finally, I wrote a letter to the Joseph Campbell Foundation in New York City. I had heard that they were editing all of his posthumous books. So I wrote a letter to them. They wrote back and they said, yes, we could use your help editing his posthumous books. Would you like to write footnotes for his travel diaries when he went to India in the 1950s? And I said, are you kidding? So I sat down and I worked on those books. It was three or four books that I helped them edit while they were still with HarperCollins. They lost their contract with HarperCollins, though, in the late 90s. This was all in the from like 1995 to 99, something like that. And so then I lost my job with them after about 5 years. So I put out my first book in 1999, Twilight of the Clockwork God, which was a series of interviews with various kind of New Age thinkers like Terence McKenna, Stanislav Grof, William Irwin Thompson, people of that nature who were alive and fascinating and interesting. So I put that out. that book did very well. And I went on from there to publish something like 26 books. I think the new book that I just put out with Brian Francis Culkin that Michael just wrote the preface for is actually my 26th book. So I've been doing this a lot for many, many years of cultural criticism. And what I've tried to do is really synthesize three different domains, starting with a background in myth studies, which is pretty much a dead field now, comparative mythology. But I have it built into me nonetheless as a foundation. Myth studies on the one hand, and then media studies, the Toronto School of Media Studies, founded by Harold Innes and Marshall McLuhan and their cohorts, Walter Ong and those guys, that whole circle, Eric Havelock. I dug into them for a while. And then I had already had a big background in German romantic philosophy from Immanuel Kant down to Nietzsche. And I was very late to warm to French postmodern philosophy. It wasn't until I was in my 40s. But once I finally did, I dug into it. And all through my 40s, I went through all through French postmodern thought, starting with Baudrillard and Paul Virilio, then went down through Deleuze and Guattari and discovered all of that. So those three worlds of philosophy, media studies, and myth studies are the three worlds that I've attempted to sort of synthesize together in order to examine culture as a phenomenon of rise, floraison, senescence, decay, and death. So I see everything morphologically as having a natural built-in life cycle, every art form, every civilization. I've inherited that mentality from the Germans. Winckelmann was the first to do that in the 18th century when he was the first to write a book about Greek art and said that Greek art went through three distinct stages, an early stage of beauty, a middle stage of perfection, and a late stage of superfluity, the Hellenistic period. He was the first to introduce that kind of thinking into German thought, which Goethe picked up from him and passed it on down. And Oswald Spengler picked it up for the decline of the West and Nietzsche as well. So that's sort of my background, and that's where I'm at. And the new book is now called Hypermodernity and the End of the World. It is available for order on Amazon right as we speak.
Well, I wanted to ask Michael about the preface because I think it's a good way to get into the sort of topic of hypermodernity. In the preface, Michael, you talk about a series of books written by a man by the name of Ingersoll Lockwood, known as the Baron Trump novels. How does that tie into hypermodernity? And maybe for my listeners that aren't familiar with how big these books, which I guess were written in the 1800s, they've sort of experienced a renaissance because of the Trump presidency. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how you tie it into hypermodernity and John's work.
Sure. So the books that I talk about by Ingersoll Lockwood are Baron Trump's Marvelous Underground Journey, which was published in 1893. And the other book is, and Lockwood wrote a series of books on this character named Baron Trump. But the other book I talk about by Ingersoll Lockwood is called The Last President, which was published in 1896. I think that's correct. And the way that I understand hypermodernity is that it's an era that's characterized by what I call semiotic excess. And the word hyper means excess. It comes from a Greek word, hooper, I think that's how you say it, which means over, like something overflowing. And I see that around the time when Nietzsche says, you know, proclaims the death of God, which I think was in the 1880s, in his book, The Gay Science, what he was saying was that there was a sort of metaphysical infrastructure that kept the real and the imaginary apart. And, you know, and the imaginary is sort of the transcendent, it's the super sensible realm of Plato that becomes the mind of God, in the medieval era of European Christendom, but that enterprise and discovery, the scientific revolution, and so forth, starts to disintegrate this metaphysical infrastructure that maintained this boundary between the real and the imaginary, and so Jean Baudrillard said that. After the death of God, the real and the imaginary sort of collapse into each other, because you can't have the real without its imaginary. You know, you can't, something is only real because you can compare it to something that's unreal, you know, something that's an imaginary. It sort of demarcates the difference between reality and fantasy and so forth. And Baudrillard says that when that happened, the imaginary fell into the real, and we get something that he calls integral reality, which is a reality that where the real and the imaginary have been sort of folded into each other, and that shows up as, you know, as the hyper real. And the way that Baudrillard talks about it is that, you know, you kind of get the impression that, you know, Baudrillard understands this as nihilism, and the imagery, like the sort of metaphors he uses, is that that when the real and the imaginary collapse into each other, everything just kind of disappears. But the way that I look at it is that at one time, you know, the imaginary was mediated and kept apart from reality. But now it's fallen into reality. And so reality becomes hyper, becomes it's overflowing with this excess of, you know, of semiosis. And we can even compare that back to pre-modern indigenous peoples who saw that the world was full of mana and gods and things like that. But the way that they understood that was mediated through sort of tribal ritualistic context. But for us, it's mediated through technical circuits that are hooked into, you know, global capitalism. So anyway, back to the Baron Trump books, it's just that this integral reality that Baudrillard talks about is, I see it as a reality that where everything is hyperfied, and it's sort of like a Twilight Zone reality. And so the Baron Trump books are or the Ingersoll Lockwood book on Barron Trump is very interesting. And so in parapsychology, you know, when you're testing someone's psi potential, I guess, right, and you're working with a psychic, you want to determine how many hits that psychic can get. You know, so can they guess what shapes are on the other side of the card, for example? You know, are they in their remote viewing? You know, are they able to describe a distant object, and how much of what they're describing matches up with what the object that they're targeting, you know, is? So there's, you know, you determine the efficacy of someone's psi potential by the number of hits they get. So what's really strange about Ingersoll Lockwood is that he wrote these two books that have a lot of hits with what we see in the mainstream media today.
Not just with the title either. I just want to
not
add
just
that.
With, not
There's
just with
all
the title
kinds
either.
Of eerie similarities. Yeah.
There's all kinds of strange sort of synchronicities in the book.
Yeah, like the Goggle Land thing, right, Michael?
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, if I could just sum it up really briefly. Just so, like, for example, Barron Trump, we all know that Donald Trump's son is named Barron. And in the story, you know, Barron Trump is a child from a wealthy aristocratic family that live in Castle Trump. And this immediately brings to mind the Trump Towers, for example. And what happens is that Barron Trump discovers a manuscript from the 15th century by a Don, you know, someone named Don Fum. But there we have another hit with Donald Trump, Don. And in this manuscript, he learns that there's a world within the world, which is also known in parapsychology as the hollow earth theory. And so this manuscript lets Barron Trump know that there's a secret entrance into this hollow earth, and there's a whole world inside of the earth. And it turns out that the only way to enter it is a portal in Russia. So independently of what you might think about collusion and all this stuff, you know, what you believe about that, the fact is, in the mainstream media, what do we hear in association with Trump all the time? We hear that the Russia had something to do with Trump getting elected, you know. So we discover that the only portal to enter into the hollow earth is in Russia. So Barron Trump sets out on this journey, and he discovers the portal, and he visits these wonderlands within the earth. And one of the lands he visits is called Google Land. Sorry, excuse me. It's actually called Goggle Land. And but you can see right there the mistake is easy to make, because it sounds like Google. And in Goggle Land, it's also called the Realm of Transparent Folk. So everybody in Goggle Land is transparent. And they're sort of like these amber-like beings. Light shines through them like amber. They're sort of like digital avatars you see on a computer screen. And everybody is wearing these goggles in Goggle Land. And it's sort of like Google Glass. It's kind of like a steampunk version of Google Glass is what it reminds me of. So you get another hit right there with Google. And this image of the hollow earth is also very significant, because the hollow earth is what Peter Sloterdijk would call the interior world of capital. It's another metaphor it's a good metaphor for the internet, that where are we when we're online? You know, where are you when you're on Google? Where are we right now? We're inside of this subtle earth, this electronic earth. You know, we're inside this what Sloterdijk calls electronic globalization, where, you know, the world is encased in these electromagnetic signals. And so the hollow earth is a way to imagine that. It's a good metaphor for that. Okay, so that's another hit that I think is really interesting.
Well, I wanted to add real quick, the other hits that I would say are in it is, you know, the title character is named Baron Trump, which of course, you know, Donald Trump's son, Baron Trump. But the title character also has a lot in common with Donald Trump. He's precocious, restless, and prone to get in trouble. This character will always mention how he has such a massive brain, he's brilliant, and he also has a personalized insult for most of the people he meets throughout his adventures. So there's a lot of like weird similarities going on there.
It's almost like Ingersoll Lockwood is the Nostradamus of hypermodernity or something like that. You know, it's like he saw into our time.
I love that.
Do you know what I'm saying? Great. Like, and it's like, it's just like with Nostradamus. It's like, you know, the way you interpret Nostradamus is, you know, you look again for these hits, you know, and you look at certain events that he's talking about and certain things match up. And a lot of things do match up with Nostradamus that are quite eerie. But it's almost like Lockwood was sort of tuned in to he was tuned in to the media of today, sort of through the collective unconscious or whatever you want to call it. And just writing this weird surrealist novel, or children's story, he put this stuff in there that just is really unusual. And then the last thing is The Last President. So then he writes a book about in 1896, he writes a book about a man who's like a business tycoon, kind of like Donald Trump, who lives in New York and, you know, on Fifth Avenue. And he's a populist, and he becomes president, and he's very controversial, and protests break out on all sides, and he has the effect of bringing about the end of the republic. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's what Donald Trump is going to do, but you see again these strange hits that a lot of people think Trump is the last president, or you know, they're from New York, they're from Fifth Avenue, they're you know, businessmen, business tycoons, and they're populists, and both sides have a controversial relationship with him. So I just see that as a way of talking about this, the fact that we're in this strange hyper modern reality now, where synchronicity sort of replaces cause and effect, you know, where, so I think that I've talked, probably John told me not to go on these long monologues because people's attention span can't quite handle it. So I'm going to stop talking.
On the other hand, these are, like we were saying before, these are podcasts, and they're 2 hours long on average. So maybe I've misunderstood the medium. So I don't know. I shouldn't be pointing.
So I just wanted to get through what those two.
No, that was great. Yeah, thanks for synopsizing that.
Well, I think it's interesting with those two books because I mean I'm pretty strict in my materialism. And I don't mean that in like the consumer materialism sense. I mean that sort of in the way a Marx would mean it. But it's fascinating to me because I feel like since we have information right at our fingertips now, we can go back into the past and find media that will make these hits. You know, and it creates this surreal effect in turn. Just the way the World Wide Web works and the information it puts us in contact with.
Maybe, but maybe not, though. I mean, a materialist worldview is one thing, but there's, you know, this stuff happens all the time. There was a guy who wrote a novel called Futility, also right about the turn of the century, about the same time as this guy was writing. I think it dates right around late 1890s, something like that, in which he depicted a ship named the Titan that was struck by an iceberg and sank. and he gave all kinds of details of the size of the ship, the weight of the ship. It didn't have enough lifeboats on it, all kinds of stuff. And lo and behold, 1912 rolls around and the thing with the Titanic happens. So a lot of people point back to that novel, Futility. Look that one up if you'd like. But events, future events do sometimes cast their shadows backwards into history. I don't pretend to know how this works or understand it. It may have something to do with the Jungian theory of synchronicity. But I think the world is much more complex and works on many more dimensions that I think we can, are puny little, you know, don't forget, these brains evolved on African savannas just to chop tools and hunt zebras or whatever. You know, that's what these brains were built for. They weren't built for understanding subtle energies and multiple dimensional realities. They weren't built to do that. And so they have trouble grasping those kinds of things. So I don't know. I always leave room for those possibilities.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good to
have that open mind. I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I'm just saying, you know, maybe.
Well, you know, I wanted to maybe get into the book a little bit more, and maybe what you mean by hypermodernity, because I think that's a term we may have to unpack a little bit, and also maybe talk about what things were like before this hypermodern period. How did we get from the Gutenberg press to the internet, in other words?
Go for it, John.
So how did we get from the internet, once again, from Gutenberg to the internet? Well, that's a media studies question, and that brings up the whole history of media studies. The bigger question is, how did we get from clay tablets to the internet? And this involves invoking the Toronto School of Media Studies, where especially the books of Harold Innes, The Bias of Communication and Empire of Communications, those two books were the books that opened up the whole field of media studies. And particularly Empire in Communications is the one where he first draws attention to the fact that, and this is what changed everything for McLuhan. McLuhan had written one book before this, The Mechanical Bride, which is a very good analysis of advertising and so forth. But he didn't have this concept yet that the medium is the message. That concept comes from Harold Innes and his study of Harold Innes in this book, where Innes says, for the first time ever, let's take a look at the evolution of media and see what relationship, how messages are communicated in a civilization affects the relationship of everything that happens in that civilization. So he looks at Babylon and he says, here we have in the Mesopotamian civilization, they're writing on clay tablets, and these clay tablets can be baked and preserved. They're basically, once they're baked, they're almost indestructible. That's why we have so many documents that still survive from Mesopotamia. And they store them in very large libraries. And so that's the first earliest form of communication that we have. But almost simultaneously with that, we have the Egyptians writing on papyrus. And the Egyptians had a monopoly on papyrus, which grew only on their soil in the Delta Valley. They had a total monopoly on it. And they're the first to start sort of writing on papyrus, although the interesting fact is they invent hieroglyphics on these little pieces of ivory from a grave from the famous Scorpion King about 3200 BC, whereas the Mesopotamians had invented writing about three centuries before that. So they first appear on these little carved ivory chips, these first hieroglyphs. So they're connected with the cult of the dead. Everything in Egypt is connected with the cult of the dead, even including writing, whereas in Mesopotamia, writing first came into being in the city of Uruk, 3500 BC, to keep track of business transactions, basically donations to the temples. The priests were very anxious about keeping track of the debts, who owned what, how many sheep, how many goats, who brought what in. So then the Egyptians have papyri, and we go through a long evolution. Of course, they carve a lot of hieroglyphs in stone, of course, but mostly papyri, lots of documents written on papyrus all the way down. And that continues through the Greeks start writing on that. But with the Greeks and the Hebrews almost simultaneously, in comes the alphabet now. Now, the alphabet comes in virtually simultaneously. There are various theories on where it came from, possibly the Phoenicians or possibly the Canaanites. We're not sure. But it seems to have come in somehow through the Hebrews, and the Greeks picked it up from them almost simultaneously. And at first, all the other civilizations of the world had been writing where you read from right to left, as is still done in Japan and Asia to this day. You read from right to left, right to left. But the Greeks were the first to start changing that direction, initially in what was called boustrophedon, which is how an ox plows a field. It carves a line into a field, then turns around, goes the other way. So what you do is you read one line left to right, then the next line you read right to left, then the next line left to right. So that's how they started, but they bring in the alphabet. And the alphabet now conceives a phonemic system of being able to think words in a much more conceptual, abstract phase space than you can ever do with, basic pictographs. Basically, the writing that came out of Sumer and Egypt is still always tied to images, and pictographs. Whereas, of course, we know the famous iconoclasm with the Hebrews and their fury against images, as Leonard Schlein wrote in his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. The first great conflict between word and image comes when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. He comes down and he sees that the Hebrews have reverted to worshiping a golden bull. They've gone back to the cult of the image, and he smashes the two tablets and orders them to grind down the bull. They melt it down, and he makes everybody take a communion meal out of it, which is interesting because the first conflict, the first collision between word and image results in the disintegration of both of them. So he has to go back up to the top of the mountain and get a second edition, as Joseph Campbell used to joke. So then we get the Greeks, we get the alphabet, they introduce eventually vowels. Vowels come in, and it begins to get more and more abstract. Finally, they settle on reading left to right, just left to right. And we get abstract thinking, and now the ground is prepared for philosophy. Now we get the ground prepared for Socrates and Plato coming in. We get Eric Havelock, who is one of the McLuhanite scholars, who comes in with Preface to Plato, where he says, why did Plato write, why did he have this idea that in his ultimate idea of an academy, that poets should be left out? Only thinkers should be in that academy, not poets. And Havelock had this brilliant idea that it had to do with the detribalization process brought about by rising rates of literacy in the time of Socrates and Plato, which is to say that with Homer, what you had initially there were oral epics. They were recited orally, they were told orally, and they were passed along orally. When you have oral traditions, this is before writing came in with the Greeks, Homer's like 750 BC, when you have an oral tradition, you have to memorize everything, not exactly by rote, but you have to memorize everything. And basically what you end up doing is you have a tribal encyclopedia. So you have this encyclopedia of proverbial wisdom and knowledge that's preset. It's already there for you. You simply inherit it from your teacher, who teaches you then what the wisdom of the tribe has been. These are the proverbs that have been for all time. Or let's say if you want to know how to make a ship, there's a passage in the Iliad that tells you how to build a boat. So this was all the oral storytelling tradition, and Havelock surmises that what writing does is it detribalizes, it sunders the individual from the group, which was basically what Socrates was doing. He was going around Athens trying to sunder every individual from proverbial wisdom by questioning truth. What do you think love means? And the person, the poor hapless individual would say, well, according to tradition, love means this. And Socrates would say, but you're not thinking for yourself, are you? Let's reexamine that. And so the detribalization process is beginning there, and the individual is being sundered from the group. Literacy rates are rising. Euripides was a huge fan of Socrates, and Euripides was the first to have a private library. So we're starting to get private libraries in the time of Plato. This is like 400 BC, Plato and Socrates. Writing's coming in, individuals are being detribalized, and the individual is now beginning to think for himself. And this changes the entire trajectory of the Western tradition from this point on. Then with the Romans come in and invent this new type of medium called the codex. At first, they have these wax tablets that you can write on. That's kind of like an etch-a-sketch. You write, I don't know if you remember the type of, we used to have these as a kid, wax tablets. You have the wax tablet underneath, and then you have this transparent tracing paper on top. You take a piece of a stylus of some kind, you write on it, you see a black letters, then you lift up the page and it erases. Then you put it back down. The Romans invented that. And that's so they're writing like that for a while. And then they invent this idea. Why don't we hinge these things and we can create something called a codex, and we can hinge them together, tie little pieces that will notch them. And we can now we have leaves. So we have each page now becomes a leaf in what basically becomes a book, a codex. So they invent the book. So now we get a new medium, a new form of communication that now comes in, and it becomes popularized, the codex. And after a while, then Egyptian hieroglyphs become extinct by the 4th century AD. just about the time that Theodosius the Great is anathematizing all the pagan traditions. He's ordering, because Christianity now, Constantine had made Christianity legal, but Theodosius, at the end, about 390 AD, makes it the only allowable religion. So he shuts everything down. The Olympics, the Vestal Virgins, everything. And the Egyptians stop writing in hieroglyphs pretty much after that. So that's the tradition then that the monks picked up, the Irish monks at Lindisfarne, about 700 AD. This is what they inherit from migratory Christian monks migrating across, trying to Christianize these German and Celtic barbarians going along. And these Irish monks pick up this little world and they start creating these books, the Book of Kells, all these illuminated manuscripts, and they start getting the Western tradition going again. Now we begin to slowly get libraries that come back, and there's an early kind of renaissance that takes place and happens now all over again. So then fast forward, let's say, to the 15th century, and we get Gutenberg coming in. Gutenberg was a German, and he's living at a time where he managed to transform, I don't know how he did this, but he managed to transform a wine press into the first printing press by coming up with this idea of having separate letters with cast into types, what are called types. That's where we get this idea of type from, as an archetype. Lining up these types along a platen and a grid and pressing it down on a page. And now we start to get shortly, about a century after that, the first newspapers start coming into being, especially popular amongst the Dutch for keeping track of the stock market. The stock market first starts to flourish amongst the Dutch about the early 1600s. They want to keep, they're really fantastic businessmen, so they want to keep track of everything. Newspapers start becoming circulated. We start getting the world now of print in a big way. The novel comes in the 18th century, and this whole world of print, this fantastic world of print that comes out of the journalistic industry. Most of these earliest, the early novelists like Richardson, the guy who wrote Clarissa, and Fielding, who wrote Tom Jones, a lot of these guys were newspapermen. And a lot of them, all the way down through the 19th century, serialized their works in newspapers and then collected them, put them together, bound them, and then put them out as novels. And that went on. We got the rise of the novel, the English novel anyway. The French were doing something different than the Russians catch on. So we get this whole wonderful world of print that flourishes and goes on all the way down through modernity, then into postmodernity, and then finally we hit hypermodernity, which now begins to liquefy everything. Hypermodernity, Michael and Brian and I draw the date at 1995 for hypermodernity, when the National Science Foundation made the internet public. At that point, everything began to melt down and liquefy everything. All technologies which had been in postmodernity analog, as Michael was saying earlier about Baron Ingersoll in modernity, which begins about the time in the middle of the 19th century, let's say the 1860s in Paris, pretty much, the technologies had been steampunk, you know, internal combustion and steam and so forth. But they had all been during postmodernity after World War II, analog technologies, cassette tapes, VCRs, celluloid, all that gets melted down into digitization, primarily with Steve Jobs as the wunderkind of most of this, quite a bit of this, of taking our gadgets and interfacing them with computers. Hey, let's take a camera and plug it into a computer. Now what happens? We no longer have nitrate surfaces to transfer images to. We eliminate the hand and tactility from the image. Everything goes straight from the brain right into the internet. So pretty soon, as the first decade of the 21st century comes around, we start seeing bookstores disappearing, melting down. Newspapers start closing down. Magazines start disappearing. Books become less and less popular. I actually have to confess that I read mostly now on the internet. When I read a book, I tend to download it from a site somewhere for free. It's very rare for me to actually sit down with a printed book anymore. I mean, I confess I've been captured by this world too. But the internet is now the new world interior. What Michael was talking about, Peter Sloterdijk referring to the world interior. Each one of these three ages, modernity, postmodernity, and hypermodernity, has its own sort of world interior retail space. Modernity, the world interior retail space, was the arcades that Walter Benjamin talked about in the Arcades Project, where the primary anthropological type was the flaneur, the stroller, the guy who casually strolls through them. In postmodernity, the world interior was the shopping mall. and the primary anthropological type there was the consumer, tied to the shopping mall and plugged into it. Now in hypermodernity, the world interior is the internet, and the primary anthropological type is the deworlded loner. The individual who has been unplugged from all of these world interiors and has left behind their empty shells, these decaying exoskeletal shopping malls that are kind of like the shells left behind, the seashells on a beach left behind by bioluminescent organisms that once inhabited them but don't anymore. They've just left their calcified shells behind. So that world is gone, and it's now all inside the internet, which is now the world interior with its whole new there's a lot of new possibilities here, and we're still exploring them. The conversation that we're having right now on Skype is one of these possibilities. So there's a lot going on here, but there's also a lot that has gone away, that this world has evanesced and seniced, and that has disappeared and has faded off the horizon behind us. So that's how I would answer your question. I know I went on quite a bit there. But
well, you know, I want to kick it back to Michael here. I do want to ask you, John, a little bit about 9/11, which plays a role in the book. But I want to ask Michael something first. As a person that's into poetry, I know John was talking about how, you know, at one point in history, literacy just sort of skyrockets, you know, and in a way, it's a liberatory force, that rise in literacy. Now we're moving into a more, I think, image-based society. What some people are saying is that we're moving towards a post-literate society, and everything is sort of based in images now, you know, with the rise of memes. What do you think the effect of that will be and its relation to hypermodernity? I know that's a big question to unpack.
Well, you know, actually, there's something about that that might be a misconception. There's a book called Digital McLuhan. I can't remember the author's name right now, but he was a colleague of Marshall McLuhan's. And he's talking about how do McLuhan's ideas map on to, you know, this, you know, what we're calling hypermodernity, which, you know, is this post-1995 world with the internet being public, and how do McLuhan's ideas map on to social media, for example, and all this kind of stuff, and McLuhan's idea that you know, televisual images, for example, retrieve this sort of auditory, that televisual images are actually auditory representations and not true images. But anyway, what he says in this book is that...
It's a book by Paul Levinson, by the way, listeners.
Paul Levinson, yes, thank you. But what he says in this book is that, you know, the internet is texts. It's not just images. It's always, you know, in fact, the internet started out as only text. You know, if you go back to the 1970s or, you know, even before, the early prototypes of the internet and of computers generally, it was text. It was writing. And now we've attached images to it. But those images always come accompanied by, you know, alphanumeric script or print. So, in a way, it's, you know, John just said that he reads all of his books, or not all of his books, but he reads many books now online, on the internet. So, you know, I don't know. I think that, I just thought that was interesting. And one thing Paul Levinson says is, just a sort of fantasy in my mind, but I think he says something like the internet takes the alphabet and makes it reverberate, with, like, it electrifies the alphabet, and throws it into this telepresent phase space. And so in a way, the internet actually is the alphabet. And I thought that was really interesting. So, yeah, I understand the question that you're asking, but I just wanted to add that in
Yeah, I think there's multiple different ways things can go. Sometimes I worry that we're living in like a more futuristic version of David Cronenberg's Videodrome, which oddly enough, one of the characters in that was based on Marshall McLuhan. And I worry about that sometimes because it kind of feels like we're living in Dr. Brian Oblivion's nightmare.
Yeah, Brian Oblivion, right. That's the character based.
Yeah. John wrote a scene-by-scene book on...
I did. Videodrome scene-by-scene. I did, yeah.
That goes into all that.
You know, the funny thing, as just as a funny footnote, is I sent it to McLuhan's grandson, Andrew McLuhan, who's friends with me on Facebook, and he didn't get it. He was like, I don't understand what you're saying. What is Cronenberg saying about my father's work? I mean, it's like he's making it out to be some sort of sinister theory. I don't think he understood the point Cronenberg was making. Anyways.
Well, not to go off in too much of a tangent, but I'd be interested in getting your take on Videodrome, maybe real briefly, because I mean, it does sort of have that sinister tone where everything is becoming image based and, you know, it can be used to control people. So I can see where Andrew was coming from on that. Andrew himself is a very interesting person. I think he's taking care of the McLuhan archives right now. People should check out his work as well.
It's a dark film, and it does have a dark portrait of Marshall McLuhan, though it's not. So I kind of get where he's coming from. But John, go on. Yeah. Tell us, illuminate us on that. That's awesome.
Well, I saw it at first. I know Cronenberg was a big fan of Thomas Pynchon. And so I remember reading The Crying of Lot 49 and the first time I read it, I didn't get it. And I had to go back a few times and read it, where the whole issue of The Crying of Lot 49 is this conspiracy of the Tristero and whether this underground conspiracy of communication that's like an alternate post office that has a certain signal of a post horn. It looks like a bugle, a muted bugle that mysteriously appears as graffiti throughout the novel here and there, that the main character, Edipa Maz is her name. She's sort of a detective type she's trying to piece the pieces together of this. She inherits this estate of this rich guy, this Ted Turner type guy who has died. She's Pierce Inverarity is his name. And she's inherited his estate. And so she's trying to figure out all these clues and piece them together. And by the end of the novel, Pynchon never tells you whether the Tristero was real or not, whether it existed or not. He never gives you the solution. And that's a classic postmodern text, to not give you the solution and to leave truth suspended so that you can make the argument either way. And there's enough evidence that Pynchon has put in the novel to support the argument for or against the Tristero. Classic postmodern novel. So I think that had a huge influence on Videodrome. And I sort of see that premise becomes the Videodrome conspiracy in the film. And Cronenberg coming out of Toronto, of course, is very well aware of McLuhan and is a fan of McLuhan. And McLuhan's idea that television is tactile. It's not, like Michael was saying a little while ago, it's not a visual medium at all. It's tactile. Because it reverses the situation of a movie theater. A movie theater is visual. When you're sitting in a movie theater, the image that you're looking at is being projected from a movie projector behind you onto the screen in front of you. So you're sitting there looking at a visual image. Light on, in other words. So it's a little bit like print in a way. It's analogous to this distinction that McLuhan made between light on and light through. Light on is what you have with the Gutenberg world. You need a candle to read this text. Whereas in the medieval period, everything was light through. You had stained glass, light through. You had illuminated manuscripts. Once again, light through. So he made a distinction between those two types of media. And so the movie theater, in a weird way, even though it's image based, sort of is still like the Gutenberg. It's sort of half Gutenberg, half new media for that time, in the sense that it's light on. The television, on the other hand, is light through, definitely, because you now are the screen and the television is the projector, which is projecting its images onto you through what McLuhan called the dance of the electrons, where electrons are rapidly scanning across your eyes in a very tactile way. They're sort of caressing your brain. They're caressing your brain with a very low resolution, especially back then, if you know remember what television looked like in the 60s, very low res, fuzzy, grainy, black and white images. that are caressing your brain with a low-res image that you then have to fill in with your own imagination. So you've got this idea of fill-in, which is another one of McLuhan's basic concepts. This is also true, he said, comics. Comics are low-res. They deliberately are low in detail so that you, the viewer, can fill in the rest. Use your imagination. He says this started in with Edgar Allan Poe inventing detective fiction. Detective fiction also is a kind of do-it-yourself where you fill in the details. You, the reader, are provided with clues. You fill in the rest. So this idea of fill-in is another McLuhan concept. Cronenberg takes over this idea that television sort of caresses you and is very tactile. Very tactile. And so he sort of literalizes it by having Max Wren sort of get sucked into it. He's given this kiss by the television itself in the shape of Deborah Harry's mouth. It's alive. It's this living, pulsing, biomechanical thing that we have this relationship with that completely sucks us into it, so that there's almost this fusion between our minds and our bodies and the technology itself. And we're not we're not aware at a subliminal level the degree to which this technology has captured us.
Television is the retina of the mind's eye, is the big quote.
Exactly right. And that's what Cronenberg is doing here, combining it with this idea of from Lot 49 of the Tristero as a possible conspiracy. Is there a Videodrome conspiracy? Or is Max Wren just hallucinating all of this? Is it a big hallucination? We never get the clear answer to that in that film. I still don't know for sure what if he hallucinated the whole thing, or if there was in fact a conspiracy of which Barry Convex, you know, was the spokesman, or is it all paranoia? So that's sort of how I see it in that book, Videodrome, scene by scene that I wrote.
Well, it's interesting because I've also heard that Cronenberg was possibly influenced by conspiracy theories that were running around Toronto at that time, that there was like a mind control project with the public access TV shows. It's weird because I think Videodrome ties into a lot of this hypermodernity stuff. It's odd to me because that movie should feel much more outdated than it is. But I mean, the sort of paranoia and the sort of global warfare game that is going on in it, if you believe the conspiracy angle and don't think it's just a hallucination, the hallucinatory nature of the internet now, I can relate to how that sort of ties in with how Max Wren turns out when he gets into the Videodrome. All these conspiracy theories about Pizzagate remind me of the snuff conspiracy in Videodrome. It's very, very prescient, despite it being about the days of VCRs.
I think, you know, I hate to cut you off here, but I can't resist inserting that Michael and I see Philip K. Dick as, in a way, as the prophet of hypermodernity. And Dick also, in addition to Pynchon, had a huge influence on David Cronenberg, and you can especially see it even more in Existence, which is a film he made in 1999. That kind of revisits the same terrain with video games. So Philip K. Dick is, you know, and Cronenberg, I think, was also ahead of the game there. Yeah. So anyways,
I would also add Robert Anton Wilson, his book Illuminatus and Schrodinger's Cat Trilogy, and all of his writings on conspiracies, which he wrote about his whole life. In fact, in the preface, I was trying to capture some of that, you know, the feeling that I got when I read Illuminatus, or sometimes when I read Robert Anton Wilson and Philip K. Dick, like that there's multiple conspiracies underneath things, and you know, this sort of magical realism, but it's, you know, so that was a great observation that, yeah, like I didn't think about Videodrome in that way, that, yeah, Videodrome does capture something about today that's going on with this. The internet makes conspiracies. It's almost like I wish Robert Anton Wilson was around right now to see, like, a lot of his ideas coming true with the internet. You know, like he would get a kick out of that Ingersoll Lockwood thing. That's why, I was sort of channeling him when I put that in the book, in the hypermodernity book. But yeah, that's really prescient, like what you're saying about Videodrome and hypermodernity. And the conspiracy culture that, you know, even like on the Joe Rogan show, you know, Alex Jones talking about the Clockwork Elves and all these ideas. It's really, I mean, I think it's really exciting stuff. It's scary and it's dark, but it also gives you a sense of adventure, a sense of wonder, a sense of mystery, I think, is ultimately what, you know, at its best, that's what conspiracy theories can retrieve for people. At their worst, you know, you get, you know, mass shootings and horrible things that happen. So it's, yeah, you know,
the guy that went into a Comet Ping Pong with like a loaded rifle.
Pizzagate, and you know, yeah. Was that what you were talking about?
Yeah. There was a believer in Pizzagate that actually went to Comet Ping Pong with like a rifle and was looking for the supposed basement. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's so. Yeah. I mean, it's it seems like that stuff, you know, one of the things that the internet does is it like I was talking about the semiotic excess, and it just, that semiotic excess expresses itself through conspiracy theories, you know, in many ways. And just this, because it's something to do with pattern recognition, trying to manage all the information overload. One of the ways that you can manage information overload is, you can even understand this in terms of the hemispheres of the brain. You can look at the, you know, the right hemisphere is more of has the sort of gestalt pattern recognition principles. And when there's information overload, it sort of activates the right hemisphere of the brain, which tries to put things into patterns, sometimes into archetypal images, or into conspiracies that give a sense of control and understanding, that fit random things into a pattern that can make sense to somebody, you know? And so we're seeing, it's almost like we have, our reality today is almost defined by conspiracies. You know, it's like, it's a conspiracy reality, you know what I mean? It's one strategy that people have adopted to deal with the semiotic excess that is the hyper of hypermodernity, and that is brought about by, to a great degree, by the internet.
Yeah, I would say it's almost like a way of dealing with how fragmented things have gotten, I think, in part due to the internet. It sort of brings me to something I wanted to ask John about. You know, we're talking about paranoia and sort of conspiracy theories sort of being on the rise now. We have this populist nationalist backlash. And I think in a way we can relate it to something you call the, I believe, Hyksos event in hypermodernity, 9/11. Maybe you could tell my listeners about why you feel that particular moment is so important in regards to hypermodernity.
Oh, the Hyksos event. I was trying to figure out the word you were using there. The Hyksos.
That's another weird thing about the internet now. You know, people don't know how to pronounce words that they only read.
Yeah. Yeah, the Hyksos. Okay, so I drew this analogy between 9/11 and an event that happened in ancient Egypt called the Hyksos event. And this took place right around, oh, let's say 1750 BC. So the Hyksos come out of the Middle East, and they are a group of mostly Semites. There might have been some Indo-Aryans mixed in with them, but they were mostly Semitic. And as a matter of fact, some of the first names that appear in the Bible, such as Jacob's name, appears amongst them as one of their rulers was named Jacob El. So their names start appearing for the first time with these guys. And they, what happened was, they perfected the two-wheel chariot and the compound bow, which the Egyptians up to that point had no use for. They didn't use chariots because all the commerce went up and down the Nile. And that's what they used, boats going up and down the Nile. They had no need for wheels up to that point. And they just didn't know about the compound bow, which enables you to fire with very great accuracy from a moving platform like a chariot. So they come in and they conquer all of northern Egypt, the entire Delta Valley. They just come in, conquer it almost overnight. And they build a kingdom in Avaris, which later becomes the city Tanis, which, of course, everybody remembers from Raiders of the Lost Ark, Tanis. which is in the Delta. So they set up this kingdom in Avaris, and they set up a dynasty of Semitic rulers there. Yaqabel is one of them. And they overturned the Egyptian sign regime. All the deities in Egypt, which had been negative, such as the god Set, who had been the antagonist of Horus, they deify. They raise Set over Horus, the Apophis serpent, which had been the primary antagonist of the sun god Re. They make him greater than Re. One of the rulers, I think, is named Apophis after them. So they turn everything upside down in Egypt, and they ruled over Egypt for a little over a century, something like a century and a half. And then long about 1550 BC, something like that, two brothers come up from the south, Amoza and Kamoza. Note the suffix there, Moza. We can start to see Moses' name slowly floating to the surface here. Amoza and Kamoza come up from the south, and they lead a massive campaign. They have taken over from the Hyksos their chariots and compound bow, and they use them to overturn the dynasty in the Delta Valley, conquer it, and chase the Hyksos out. And from that point on, not only do they get rid of the Hyksos, but they proceed to build for the first time an Egyptian empire where they conquer all the Middle East. The entirety of Palestine now becomes Egyptian property. They conquer the whole thing all the way up to the Taurus Mountains, which was the kingdom of the Hittites. The Hittites were a bit too tough for them, so they had to stop it there. And they drew up a bunch of treaties with the Hittites. And so that's how the great men like Tutmosis III was kind of the Julius Caesar figure who led most of these campaigns in Palestine. And so that's the situation that happened there as the great Hyksos event that I drew as analogous to 9/11. That was our great Hyksos event where an alien sign regime from the Middle East comes in and attempts to introduce an overcoating process into the West. And we respond at that point by it's time to build an empire now. Not an empire in the sense of the Marshall Plan empire, but an actual surveillance state empire where we're everywhere now. We've got eyes in the sky, drones that can disintegrate you wherever you're at the touch of a button, just like a video game. We can simply eliminate you. So now you're on the inside of the American empire and its surveillance state apparatus. And so, but the other point though that's tied in with this that I was making about this is that every one of these epochs, modernity, postmodernity, and hypermodernity, is punctuated by some sort of a major world war or catastrophe, just like geological epochs are. We have geological epochs, and there's like 15 or 20 of them, because every single one of them is demarcated by a major global catastrophe, not just comets, but very often a whole bunch of volcanoes around the planet would start erupting. But every one of them is demarcated by a major catastrophe that demarcates one epoch from the next.
Cultural Can I comment epochs, on that real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, you even see that with the sort of economic epochs. We get Keynesian economics because of, you know, the excesses of, you know, the Depression and the Gilded Age. And then we move, you know, Keynesian economics fails, and we get Reaganomics, neoliberalism. And now it seems like that's failing. And it's interesting because each time it seems like these epochs get shorter and shorter.
Yes, they do. Exactly. And so let me make this last point then to make sense out of this comparison, which is that, let's say, the shift from the Enlightenment to modernity was punctuated by the catastrophe of the Napoleonic Wars. Okay, so that's that sort of world war that takes place there. Then we get the shift into modernity with Napoleon III in Paris in the middle of the 19th century and his plan to rebuild Paris. And he brings in Baron Haussmann as his primary city architect, and they completely redesign and rebuild Paris. And modernity proper now begins. And we get Manet as the new artist who gets rid of all the earlier art iconotypes, Greek myth, Christian mythology. He gets rid of all of that. And then Baudelaire becomes the official new poet who writes about, you know, beautiful poetry about the city now. Those two guys are the architects now, one within poetry, one within painting for modernity. And so along comes that whole generation. And then the shift from modernity to postmodernity is, of course, punctuated by the world wars, World War I and II, which was basically one war where everybody took a break in between them. That's pretty much what it was. And then we get postmodernity. And then we get from that, we also, you know, we get the shift of the art world out of Paris, which then shifts to New York. We get the atom bomb going off, eliminating matter into pure energy, just as Jackson Pollock out on Fireplace Road is discovering with lavender mist and paintings like that, the drip canvases. He's eliminating form and turning it into pure vortices of energy, just as Mark Rothko is also eliminating the modernist archetypes and turning those into what I call semiotic vacancies. And this is what inspired Michael Kamen's poetry cycle, Absences, the semiotic vacancies now, which Derrida, at the same time across the water in Paris, is writing about in Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences, where he says, there is now no longer a transcendental signified at the heart of the Western sense of being. Instead, there's a vacancy now. The at the heart of Western being, all the transcendental signifieds that held it in place, such as the cross or all the great meta-narratives, those are all gone now. And so all the signifiers now have free play. They can all skate around like ice skaters going across a pond with nothing to hold them in place anymore. So signification can now run amok. It's totally a free-for-all. And so now we get the shift from post-modernity to hyper-modernity marked with 911. And keep in mind, though, 911, we drew the date at 1995, whereas 911 happened in 2001. But the first attack on the Trade Towers, of course, took place in 1993 when Ramzi Youssef actually tried to blow them up. If that attack had been successful, the timing would have been much closer with those two. So that was the significance of why I drew 911 as analogous to the Hyksos event.
I don't know. Michael, is there anything you want to add to that? Maybe I think you're a little bit younger than John. What was your sort of take on 9/11 and how it's sort of affected the landscape media-wise, personally, and socially in our world?
I mean, I think at this point, I mean, I can only just speak personally about it. I remember 9/11. I was 18, and my mom burst into my room screaming, you know, that it's something like it's the end of the world or alerting me that something was going on. And then she puts on the TV in my bedroom and I see the second plane crash into the other tower. And it really did feel like the end of the world for a moment, just that, you know, being held in that suspense. And then actually my mother saying this and then actually seeing the image happen. And so, I mean, I think after that, I mean, I guess just things just haven't really felt the same since that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the end of the world. It's interesting because I think the end of the world narrative manages to come up a lot throughout, you know, history. But now it seems to come up more and more, but it comes up in a very weird way. I almost feel like at times there's a longing for the end of the world. You know, I think it was Zizek or Frederick Jameson who talked about the late logic of capital being postmodernism. I think both of them have said, you know, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And I think capitalism really ties into a lot of what John is talking about. When you write about neoliberalism or surveillance capitalism, John, I almost get a vision of, you know, like the blob, you know, the horror movie monster, the blob sort of consuming everything and commodifying everything and just devouring everything. Right. Maybe you can elaborate on how neoliberalism and now the Silicon Valley surveillance capitalism tie into what we see with hypermodernity.
Yeah. This is more Brian Culkin's specialty. He's very good with economics and looking at all this sort of from the ground up. But the idea is that so in hypermodernity, what we have is Silicon Valley technologies, computational technologies coming out of Silicon Valley wed to neoliberal capitalism. Neoliberalism, of course, is something that came in with the Reagan administration. So it's been around for a while, with Milton Friedman and so forth. But then with the Clinton administration, it becomes global with NAFTA and all these new things that start coming in. And then when those two meet and they get wed together, we get basically neoliberalism now on steroids. And we start to get this idea that now it's possible to capitalize not just on goods and on selling things and information, but also on, let's now capitalize on things like friendship. So we get Facebook. Now we can make money off of friendship. With Tinder, we get ideas. Now we can make money off of romance or Match.com or all the various dating sites. Everything is about making money off human relationships now, which I find to be very cynical and very there's just something sinister about the whole thing. Even though I have to say that, you know, I've met a lot of nice people on Facebook. A lot of close friends have come to me through Facebook. But nonetheless, there is this idea that neoliberalism going through Silicon Valley circuitry de-worlds the individual and unplugs the individual from his or her local horizon, creates a sort of clone or avatar of that individual, which then transfers the avatar into hyperspace and puts it into orbit around the planet like a satellite in the exosphere. And as a deworlded avatar, we encounter each other in the sort of planetary exospace as deworlded individuals, where wherever you're at, whatever local world horizon you came out of, whether it was India or China or someplace in Kansas, doesn't even matter. We just encounter each other as these deworlded avatars. The phrase deworlded comes from Heidegger, by the way. He was the master of understanding how science deworlds things. I sort of borrowed that from him to apply this logic to hypermodernity and how it deworlds individuals and it sunders them not only from locality but also from social groups, from communities, from any sense of being part of a neighborhood at all. I don't even think Facebook would have come into being in the first place if there hadn't already been a problem with disintegrating communities. You know, we have to rewind back a bit to remember Jane Jacobs talking about what the automobile did back in the 60s in her famous diatribes, what the automobile did to cities. Basically, it created urban sprawl, and it takes cities and stretches them out elastically so that now you can't just walk up the street and say hi every day to 10 or 12 people that you know. You have to get in your car and drive down the street where you no longer have any contact with people to wherever it is that you're going to go. And so the automobile, Jane Jacobs used to talk about, it has a disintegrative effect on community. And there are other things that technology does that disintegrates communities. And so I think that I don't even think Facebook would have come into being in the first place. You know, there's something called, in communications theory, there's something called phatic communication, P-H-A-T-I-C, which is just communication that's just social. You just say hi to someone. You know, it's like birds chattering in a tree. It's just pure sociality, and it doesn't perform any other function than that. And in a way, Facebook comes into being to serve that purpose. But it's like, why would we need that if we weren't already getting that elsewhere? You know, it's sort of like, why would you need porn unless you didn't have a love life, if you didn't have a real love life? I mean, we're getting all these prostheses, these substitute replacements for real human relations that I think is an alarming index that points to the paucity of human interaction now. Human interaction is mediated now through neoliberal economics wed to Silicon Valley circuitry. And there's something sinister about the whole thing. I just don't like it, and I'm not comfortable with it. I'm playing the game. I'm here. I show up, but I'm not comfortable with it.
Well, there's not necessarily an option out. Well, maybe for now, although I guess in Italy there's something that arose in the 90s called the slow movement, where everyone was sort of getting away from technology. I could see that happening here, maybe. It's interesting, though, in terms of neoliberalism, one of the points, I think it was Brian that made this point, that Donald Trump sort of wants to decouple neoliberalism from globalization. And I thought that was prescient because I just had a guest on, TJ Coles from Britain. He does a lot of really great research. And he was saying the exact same thing about characters like Boris Johnson, that these are hyper-capitalists that want to be against the EU, against globalization. And yet, you know, how do you decouple neoliberalism from globalization? It seems like an impossibility. Maybe both of you could comment on that or just the Trump phenomena in general.
Well, I had compared, and this, we retrieved this in the book, where I had compared And this is interesting because it does link back with Baron Trump's adventures and the second book that Michael was talking about, The Last President, where he was saying that the plot of – I haven't read these books. But he was saying that the plot of The Last President was about a populist who gets elected and then brings about the end of the republic, which is interesting because I wrote a blog about Donald Trump back in January of 2016, where I pretty much knew that he was going to win based on Oswald Spengler's idea that we are at where we're at right now, right around, he said this would be right around the year 2000 when we would hit a point where the Caesars would start filing on stage, what he called the Caesars. A better phrase is Toynbee's phrase for a universal state, or what I just described with the Egyptians building an empire. That they were building a universal state. So those men appear just as the Republic is disintegrating. And I drew an analogy between Trump and this figure Crassus, who was part of the first triumvirate with Julius Caesar, Crassus, and Pompey. Julius Caesar, of course, of the three of them, he was the least wealthy at first, and he went off to make his fortunes in Gaul by conquering Gaul and then sending back Celtic slaves. And then he made fortunes off of that. So he solved his financial problems doing that. And then Pompey was a great military man who was very popular. He cleaned up the pirates of the Mediterranean and he made the Mediterranean a safe place for travel. And he was very popular. And he was also a war hero, you know, one of these guys, one of these generals, like a kind of Eisenhower figure, let's say. Whereas Crassus, I compared Trump to a Crassus type of figure, which is a figure who made absurd amounts of wealth based on owning these huge sort of slave plantation corporations called latifundia, giant mega machine slave plantations, but also real estate. He owned all this real estate all over Rome and these huge sort of apartment buildings that were the only large multi-level buildings in Rome called insuli. And they had the habit of collapsing during earthquakes. So they weren't very well built, but he was making a lot of money off of them. And then Crassus decided at one point, he destabilized the triumvirate by deciding to go and he wanted to copy Alexander the Great and go and conquer the Middle East and go all the way to India. So he and his son pack up Roman troops and they go to Palestine, but they encounter there, not the Hyksos, but on the turn of the spiral here, many, many centuries later, but the Parthians, who were just as tough. And the Parthians also had the compound bow, except they rode on horseback, and they were even deadlier than the Hyksos. And they chopped off Crassus's head, they chopped off his son's head, they made mincemeat out of the Romans, and the Romans were horrified by this, but it destabilized the triumvirate. And so now it just became a war between Pompey and Caesar, and Pompey began to get very nervous because he knew what a great military man Caesar was. He thought geometrically, just like Napoleon did. He was very good at solving problems on the battlefield by applying geometry to his troops. And so Caesar comes back, he crosses the Rubicon, everybody leaves Rome. Overnight, it becomes a ghost town. By the time Caesar and his troops get there, they're there, there's nobody there, and Pompey has fled. And he's fled across the way to Greece. He's gone to Pharsalia. Caesar chases him over there. They meet on the battlefield. Caesar is vastly outnumbered by Pompey, but he still wins anyway because he's a military genius. He defeats Pompey, but Pompey himself and his wife and family flee, and they go across the water to Egypt. And the moment they step off the boat at Alexandria, one of the guys has gotten word that he's coming, and they chop off his head. The guy chops off Pompey's head. So Caesar is the last man standing from that first triumvirate, and he becomes, of course, the first great dictator of Rome, the first Caesar figure. That doesn't last long, and we get a second triumvirate. And then Augustus, of course, his nephew, becomes the first great true emperor. But nonetheless, the thing that's interesting to compare about Trump is not just with Crassus, but with this idea that what these men signify is that these are money men who come on stage with such huge private fortunes that they can now afford private armies. And this is a new thing in Rome. This has never happened before, where you have each man paying vast armies. They have enough wealth to pay vast armies who give their loyalty not to Rome, but to the guy who's paying them all this wealth. And so each one of them could afford a private army. That's why they went to war against each other in these civil wars. So I don't know. That makes me nervous about Trump and, you know, how chummy he is with military figures and generals, and especially with Eric Prince of Blackwater. I wonder about stuff like that. And so, but based on that anyway, the analogy, I predicted that he would win. because I think the age is ripe for this kind of money man to come in and hijack democratic electoral politics. And I think maybe it could, you know, he could bring about the end of the Republic. Who knows? I mean, the guy makes me nervous. You just can't predict a man like this. You can't predict what he's going to do.
Well, he's very different from the sort of figures that could get elected in the past. He's
yes.
I mean, I
in every sense of the word. Yeah.
Well, I forget if it was you or Brian that mentioned it, but you know, this is very different from like a Thomas Jefferson or a what we think of as a statesman. He is the first Twitter celebrity president, really. I mean, I guess you could say Reagan was like a B movie actor that became president, but he had much more experience in politics. I mean, Trump is much
a governor
more anonymous.
Of California. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Reagan at least had been a governor for a while in California. He did have some experience. Right.
Michael, do you have anything to add? Maybe your thoughts on the Trump phenomena and its relation to hypermodernity?
I don't think, apart from what I talked about earlier with the Barron Trump, the Ingersoll Lockwood conspiracy, I guess if you want to call it that. I tend to agree with John's point of view that there's something that's interesting in Oswald Spengler is that he says that the second religiousness will coincide with this stage of Caesarism that John is talking about, that he sees Trump as representing. And I've always had the sense that this hypermodernity thing that comes out of this sort of it's almost like we have this internet spirituality. You know, it's almost like the way that we relate to the internet and even the metaphor of the net, which goes back to early Christianity, you know, where Christ said he was going to make his apostles fishers of men. I see that we're sort of in the second religiousness now. And one thing Spengler said is the second religiousness is when the original spiritual ideas of a civilization, after sort of having been forgotten or diverged from, sort of reoccur in an almost very conservative manner. And if it's the case that, you know, we see Caesarism on the political stage with Trump, as John's talking about, then you could say that somehow the attitude we have about the internet, the sort of the enmeshment we have within it, where it becomes a kind of new church that, you know, one thing that the church does is it creates this sort of participation mystique within the community, and that everybody is sort of in the water of the church. Everyone is like a little fish swimming in the water, and it sort of brings everybody together. And that's very much part of the metaphor landscape that's come in since 1995 with the internet. So I think it's interesting because I think there's a sort of a religious and something you said earlier, you were talking about capitalism and the end of the world. But the end of the world is a much older part of our culture, of our civilization, than capitalism. I mean, it's built into the major text of our civilization, which is the Bible.
You know, I agree with that. I think it's always been here, these sort of fantasies of the end of the world. I guess
eschatological, yeah.
Right. The immanentitize the eschaton, so to speak. I think that with sort of the rise of neoliberalism, it becomes almost akin to like wanting it. And I guess there have always been cults and groups that sort of want it to hasten the apocalypse. But it almost feels like it's become more of a trope now.
Well, this is interesting because this is also an old thing in our culture as well that goes back to the alchemists, actually, and Hermeticism generally. And it also goes back to Christianity as well, where, you know, the apocalypse, which means a revelation, a revealing, you know, it ends with the Holy Jerusalem descending like some, you know, some starship that comes down as this new heavenly city, you know, and it's the apocalypse is our way back into the garden, you know, so to speak. It's so it almost reminds me of like what Terence McKenna used to talk about a lot with his time wave zero idea and this transcendental object at the end of time that's pulling our civilization towards it. You know, I think it's a really great metaphor, a really great image that really does. I really do see that as a way of mapping the story of the Bible, you know, from Genesis to Apocalypse, or, you know, the book of Revelation. I really do see this idea that the revelation of this transcendental object at the end of time that McKenna is talking about, this sort of singularity, which you could easily say is the heavenly Jerusalem that comes down at the end of the book of Revelation. I think that his way of talking about it actually is an expression of the dynamics of the central myth that's driving our culture. So there is a central myth driving our culture towards the end of the world. And with the alchemists, for example, they were interested in creating the Philosopher's Stone. And the Philosopher's Stone was not necessarily just gold, right? It wasn't just like manufacturing currency. It also wasn't necessarily a personal thing. It wasn't, the alchemists didn't believe that they required, their souls required salvation, because Christ came and saved the soul of man. The alchemists believed that they had to complete Christianity, at least the, you know, alchemy goes back before Christianity, but the Christian alchemists, the European alchemists of the Renaissance and so forth, they believed that they had to save the soul of the world, and that Christ sort of half completed his project, you know what I mean? And it was up to the alchemists to save the soul of the world, which they thought of as the Gnostic Sophia that had fallen in from this pure light world and then got trapped in matter, and that they had to sort of take the matter apart and sublimate it to liberate this, you know, the spiritual soul of the world. Anyway, my point is that to do that, so they saw the Philosopher's Stone as a historical achievement, not just a, you know, about the personal salvation of the soul. They saw it as bringing, immanentizing the eschaton, as you said, which is a quote from Robert Anton Wilson's book Illuminatus. But it's actually something that I have a friend who's a Quaker, and when I he read the introduction and he read that quote, he recognized that quote, and he recognized it as something within his family tradition or something he had heard around the household, you know, growing up, about this immanentizing the eschaton. So I'm thinking, okay, well, Wilson probably, you know, adapted that from, it must be some kind of a traditional saying or some variant of it or something like that. But my point is that it's always been about immanentizing the eschaton. You know, that's been the central engine driving our civilization. And the alchemists represented that as this philosopher's stone. And one vision that I have is that I sort of see the internet as actually achieving that. That's kind of that hyper object at the end of time is this hyper modernity, and the ultimate alchemical achievement. And I'm going to stop with this because I know I'm going on and on about this, but the ultimate alchemical achievement is a sublimated philosopher's stone, which is comparable to Hegel's idea of sublation or Aufhebung, I think is how you pronounce it. So they believed that you create the philosopher's stone, but then there was another stage beyond it where you sublimate the philosopher's stone. You turn it into some sort of ethereal product. And they called that the sky blue kalum. And it was represented by the color blue, whereas the more traditional alchemical colors are red, black, and white. This was blue, and it had to do with the firmament, and it was about creating this product that could create its own firmament. And the thing that I've noticed, and this is the book that I have coming out in hopefully in September called Clouds, is that we now see the icon of the cloud everywhere. And I see that, you know, as sort of an archetypal psychologist who's interested in the history of images, I see the fact that the cloud, and it's not just one corporation that has the iCloud, right? It's every media corporation and so forth has this icon of the cloud. So we see it everywhere we look. Everywhere we look, we see the cloud. And So it's almost like hypermodernity is actually living in this after the future. It's actually living in after history. We've actually created this post-historical world, and we're actually living in the after the eschaton.
The cancellation of the future, as Mark Fisher has referred to it.
But see, this is what I'm saying, is that, and I'm a poet, not really a theorist, not true intellectual necessarily either, I just see things and they inspire me in an almost religious way, you know what I mean? So when I see the cloud everywhere, it reminds me of this ultimate alchemical achievement, and it makes me think that, yes, cancel the future, or, maybe that's synonymous with actually we've actually created the future. We've actually realized the future. We've actually realized the Western virtual imaginary, and that's what the internet actually is. It's a concretization, a literalization of the implicit metaphors and myths that drove our civilization, and we've actually literalized them in a sense, and that's kind of like, it's sort of like we've achieved, and I don't mean this literally, right, and I don't mean this like as some techno utopian, because I don't think of it in that way. I see it as actually the final stage, perhaps, in our civilization, where we've sort of achieved. Spengler says our civilization is Faustian. Goethe wrote about Faust, the doctor who sold his soul to the devil, who was named Mephistopheles. And Goethe and Christopher Marlowe wrote about Faust, but there actually was a Dr. Faustus, probably in I think in the 1600s or before then. But our civilization is a Faustian civilization, which is obsessed with conquering infinite space, which is about, in other words, progress. And so one last thing on this, it's kind of like if Spengler was right, and maybe I'm extending my metaphors too much and taking my metaphors too literally, which is sort of, I can get away with that being a poet, I guess. But, maybe hypermodernity, which comes about in 1995 with the establishment of the internet, at least publicly, is the realization of that Faustian virtual imaginary. Whereas other civilizations come apart before they get to that stage, it would sort of be the destiny of Faust to actually realize the actual seed ideas, the Erbpflanz that Spengler talks about, the original seed that becomes the flower of a civilization. Maybe we've actually realized the hypermodernity as the realization of that. And we see that in the internet and in the image of the cloud. And that's just a poetic perspective that doesn't necessarily map on to the political, economic, and other realities that you're talking about. It's kind of my own fantasy.
Well, I think that's a really interesting perspective. It's interesting because when we're talking about the realization of an endpoint or even the end of the world, another thing that I think you guys touch upon a little is this idea of post-humanism or, post-humanity, I should say, and transhumanism. Now, I think transhumanism is a really out there type thing that isn't going to happen. I think in a lot of ways it's possible that it can be used to mainstream or be used as cover for things like eugenics. But there is an interesting philosophical question contained within transhumanism, whether you believe it's possible or not. And namely, that's this idea of, people like Ray Kurzweil saying we're going to reach the singularity. We'll become one with the machines. And they sort of paint that as being the next evolution of the human species. But I don't see how that's even possible. To me, that would be the end of the human species as we know. It would be sort of the embodiment of the end of the world.
Yeah, that's one thing that we mean in the book by the end of the world is exactly these guys with this ridiculous techno-utopian fantasy of merging with artificial intelligence. This is an old idea. I mean, it's been around for a while. Cryogenics was one thing that I think got this wrong, where you just preserve a cell, freeze it, and then at some point the technology will evolve to the point where you can reanimate the whole body. But the problem is that it assumes that the body is just material, and it's not. It's animated by a soul. You can't call the soul back down into a body once that soul has left that body. There's that. But there's also the idea that we are, in a sense, as a Faustian civilization, like Michael was saying, we are already one with our machines anyway. A Faustian civilization has sprouted machines like the earth sprouts plants. I mean, that's been our primary thing. That's been our primary fetish, is the machine. You get Spengler talking in The Decline of the West about how you can already see this in Nuke, in seed form, by these Gothic monks back in the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe, like Vitello and Petrus Peregrinus, who are already playing around with magnets and are fascinated with the properties of light and optics. They've inherited optical treatises up through Spain from the Arabs, and they're fascinated already with figuring out the properties, and they already have the fantasy of the possibility of a perpetual motion machine, which would be a miniature imitation of God's cosmos. To master that would be like the ultimate fantasy of these guys, because that's basically in their minds what God had done, was create the cosmos as a perpetual motion machine. You just give the spheres a kick and they start whirling around the earth. Everything is going around the earth. And it's a perpetual motion machine that doesn't have any friction. Nothing dissipates. And that, in a sense, this idea, metaphysically, there's this idea that what is it that sets a body in motion? Well, initially, it was thought by the ancients that you set a body in motion and a body will move so long as it remains in contact with a motive force. So let's say I'm pushing a shopping cart. So I'm pushing a shopping cart along and I let it go and it stops. It coasts along for a second and it stops. The reason it stopped, according to the ancients, was because I stopped putting force on. I stopped pushing it. Well, the Faustians turned this around. And they said, no. The reason it stopped was because of friction and resistance put up against the wheels by the ground. So what you need to do is make a super smooth surface, oil the wheels, and when you let go of it this time, it'll go way farther. So now we're moving into Galileo playing around with balls, rolling balls down inclined planes and designing planes. This comes out of the metaphysics of these Gothic monks. They're rolling balls down inclined planes, and lo and behold, they're rolling farther and farther and farther. So now the presupposition becomes, and this is the idea of inertia, the first law of motion. Now the idea becomes that a body, and this Newton inherits this, a body will remain in motion forever. That's its fundamental purpose. It will stay in motion forever unless its motion is dissipated by contact with some impeding external agency. Friction, in other words. So this makes possible, for the first time ever, the idea of Faustian mechanics. Let's put things in motion and eliminate friction, and now we can create all kinds of machines with the ultimate goal, the grail of engineering and mechanics in the West, being a perpetual motion machine, a machine that will run forever, simply by figuring out how to eliminate all resistance to that machine. That's been the goal of Faustian civilization forever. But notice that physical, actual things take place and happen and unfold in reality through fantasizing, through coming up with images, fantasies, and metaphysical ideas that then become inspirations for things happening on the physical plane. So they do have effects on the physical plane that make things happen. So I'll give the techno-utopians that much, that fantasies do tend to make things happen. But on the other hand, there are good fantasies and bad fantasies. And I think the idea about merging with machines into artificial intelligence completely underestimates the nature of the human psyche. It presumes that the human psyche is replicable and duplicable, that we know enough about it and how it works to duplicate it, which we do not. Freud was the first, the Germans were the first. Schopenhauer and Edvard von Hartmann and guys like that were the first to begin figuring out, hey, wait a minute, and Schelling, hey, wait a minute, the psyche contains an abyss within it. There's an abyss of motives that comes out of this that is completely ununderstandable by the reason. The reason is a faculty for figuring out mathematics and the way things are, the way things are put together. But the abyss of the human psyche is something that you can't fully understand. And so Freud eventually translates this into scientific discourse as the unconscious. Jung inherits it. But it is true. We don't know how the human brain works. It's an abyss of meaning. We still don't know how dreams work, where they come from, why they happen. There's all kinds of things about the human psyche that the rational mind simply cannot understand, will never understand, because it's not built for that purpose. It's not built to understand those things. And unless it can get a correct picture of those things, then it can't replicate them. So there's no way you can ever fully replicate the way the human mind works and translate it into a machine. It's not going to, it's just the wrong paradigm. It's a reductionist model of the human psyche. So I just think it's wrong. And it's based on a misunderstanding of the human psyche. It's a shallow view. And I don't think it has a future. I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
So what do you think is going to happen, John? You think that the grid will get unplugged or something like that? Or will?
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing. I mean, I'm not, I've looked at the history of the Earth. I know it very well, the history of the entire planet, as well as the history of civilization. And chaos and catastrophe always happen. They always intervene at some point and shut systems down. It's inevitable. We think we've built a civilization that's so clever that we've eliminated, you know, just like these guys trying to eliminate friction to get a perpetual motion machine. We think we've eliminated the possibility of catastrophe. But I know for a fact that that's not the case, that civilizations can and do encounter catastrophes that simply wipe them out, that they become overwhelmed. This has happened again and again and again throughout history. Look at, just to take a micro example really quickly, look at the history of Mohenjo-Daro, which is a site from Harappan civilization, 2500 BC, in the Indus Valley. That was a civilization where, when you look at it, they had trouble with flooding. The Indus River kept flooding over the centuries as it was there, down to about 1600 BC. And every time it flooded the city catastrophically, they had to rebuild the whole city. And as you look at the stratigraphy of the rebuilding of the city, every time they rebuilt it, it's shoddier and shoddier and shoddier until finally they just gave up and left the city. That to me is how history works. Eventually, the system is going to give way to entropy, and it's going to hit thermodynamic equilibrium eventually at some point, as all systems do, whether they're living or non-living. At some point, they hit maximum entropy, and that's it for that system. So I don't believe in these dreams of technology as the salvific force that's going to save us and keep this civilization running forever. It's not going to happen.
Well, it hasn't done a real good job of dealing with the rise of right-wing populism that many centrists and leftists are worried about. It hasn't done a good job dealing with climate change either. I mean, we're told that science is going to solve all our problems, but in a way, a lot of science and a lot of the R&D that was funded for science contributed to a lot of these climate change issues.
Yeah, right. That's right. I mean, and then plus, as we talk about in the end of the book, science has given us the first scientifically approved eschatology ever now. Now we've got science that keeps giving us things back from ancient myth and religion that were once, like the eye of Horus flying through the sky. Now we have satellites going around the earth. Or, in the Hindu mythology, like in the Ramayana, if you read the Ramayana, they're always flying around on these weird flying machines. And lo and behold, now we have Garuda Airlines in Indonesia. science keeps giving us these things back that used to be just the sphere of myth and religion. And, so now it's given us this eschatology that, in 5 centuries, all the ice is going to be melted on in Greenland and in Antarctica. And it's scientifically calculable. It's a 70-foot sea level rise, which means all the coastal cities are going to be underwater. There's no two ways around that. You can't reverse it. You can't change it. We've already set it into motion. There's something called climate inertia, which is based on the calculation of how much CO2 we've put into the atmosphere, how quickly we've put it there. And we have put so much of it there that we haven't even caught up to it yet. The Earth's climate has not even caught up to the amount that we've put in there. It's something like 400 parts per million right now, 400, which is the highest it's been in a million years. It's been a long time since it's been that high. During ice ages, it goes down to 200 ppms. Ice ages seem to be attempts to keep the CO2 levels down. The Earth doesn't like being too hot. So we've got that. I mean, we've got 5 centuries of melting ice to look forward to. So we've got to start thinking about this problem of what we're going to do about our coastal cities. They're going to have to be abandoned one way or another. So that's a huge set of problems, because we'll be dealing with a lot of displaced populations, dealing with the Syrian migrant crisis in Europe is, that's a harbinger of things to come. Or New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina and, all the problems that we had to deal with there, all the cities in the Southwest, a lot of them ended up all the way into Phoenix. We were trying to deal with refugees from Hurricane Katrina. That's just a tiny little sampling of what we have in store for us as these cities sink from storm surges and ever rising hurricanes that are getting larger and larger. We're going to start getting new categories of hurricanes, categories 7 and 8, super hurricanes that will get larger and larger. And so we're going to have to especially places like Bangladesh, which is one of the lowest lying level places in the world that's going to flood very soon. What are we going to do without that population? India doesn't want those people inside of its borders. So we're going to have huge crises headed our way of a lot of displaced populations with no place to go and people who don't want to take them in. So there's that, in addition to a lot of other structural, infrastructural rearrangements having to adapt to all these climate changes.
Did you hear about the Apophis asteroid of 2029?
No.
Like, I think NASA just put out this report that in 2029, there's an extinction event asteroid that's going to be so close to our planet that it's going to pass underneath where the satellites, the revolution of the satellites.
The exosphere.
Yeah. So it's going to be that close to the Earth. And wow.
That's really close.
Yeah, and it's called Apophis, which is an Egyptian dragon.
Kidding me.
Yeah, somebody named Egyptian. It, but it's crazy. It's like
name for that.
I mean, they say there's like a 1 in 1,000 chance or something like that it could get steered off course and actually hit the Earth. But it's really fucking close, man. Like, it's closer than our satellites.
This is 2029.
In 2029, yeah. So it's kind of like Apophis is going to be giving us the passing
by. 10 years.
10 years, yeah. Who knows? Maybe the calculations are wrong. And a lot of people think that we'll be able to deal with an asteroid. Kind of like what you were saying, that we think we're so clever that we'll come up with some sort of technological solution to all of these things. And a lot of people believe that. A lot of people think that there is always some solution that we'll come up with. And maybe there is, I don't know, but something like this, from what I've looked into about it, I always thought that they had a plan to steer an asteroid away, whether it's, shooting or attaching guided rockets to it or something like that. But I don't think there's any plan in place. And we know that asteroids do bring extinction events and have in the history of this planet. I mean, 65 million years ago, dinosaurs.
Right.
I'm sure there have been other ones as well. Mm-hmm. So who knows,
Well, I wanted to ask John maybe one more question. I know we've been talking a lot about Spengler, and he's a very controversial figure because, he's, of course, a counter-revolutionary. So he's placed within the right, but there's a lot of leftists that have taken an interest in him, people like Zygmunt Bauman. There's a lot of people that were even farther to the right than Spengler that took an interest in him. But one of his things was sort of looking at civilization almost like a human body, that has a life and death cycle. And I know you're very interested in that conceptually. I've always been a little bit worried by it. You were talking about good and bad ideas. my thing with that sort of metaphor, you know, a civilization or a state as a human body, is that can very easily be turned into an excuse for sort of exterminationist philosophies. You know, historically, what I'm talking about are genocides, things like the Holocaust. Do you think that your view of that, view of this life cycle, can be decoupled from that sort of exterminationism that we often find in league with that? Or do you get what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. Well, for one thing, it's a metaphor, and I take it as a metaphor.
It's also a plant, right? Isn't it a plant, not a body?
It's a plant. Yeah, it's like a tree. He imagines it because he took it from Goethe's model of the Erbpflanze. Yeah, so he thinks of it as a plant. I don't necessarily take it literally. And his British competitor, Arnold Toynbee, rejected it completely. He didn't like the biological determinism that it implies. But the problem is with that, that's fine. So you read Toynbee. So I sat down and I read Toynbee. You do that. You reject Spengler's determinism and the biological analogy, but with Toynbee, you still come out, after you do all the math, you still come out with the same result, namely that all civilizations are mortal, every single one of them. You can't find a single example where they're not. So whether the metaphor is literally true or not, it is nonetheless the case that civilizations are mortal things, that they have a kind of life cycle to them. They have a kind of vitality to them. And they have a kind of, let's put it this way, that what brings them all into being in the first place to begin with are religious visions in every single case. There is no exception to that rule whatsoever. Every single one of them comes into being as the result of a series of religious visions, usually by very few individuals. It might only even be one, as in the case of Christ or Muhammad, or a small elite group, as in the case of India with the Rishis. But it's always a set of religious ideas that then over time, those religious ideas come into being, and then they act almost like DNA. They act as a code that bring culture forms into being, physical, actual things, the way people dress, the way clothes are made, the way people act, the way temples are designed, or whether there are temples or not. All of that comes out of these religious ideas. And so you get this process of the semantic unfolding of religious ideas into material concrete reality, into infrastructure.
The seed ideas, you know.
Yeah, the arca, what I call the arca. Yeah, over time. But those ideas, though, seem to me to have, they don't have an infinite potential to them. There's only so much. It's like, you know, with movies, when you get a set of films like the Indiana Jones movies, there's only so many things you can do with them. There's a reason why each Indiana Jones film is worse than the one before it. Same thing with the Star Wars film. There's only so much potential that the initial set of ideas has that you can unfold out of it, so that over time those ideas become then semantically depleted. And as they become semantically depleted, the civilization begins to sort of grow old in a sense. It begins to lose touch with its initial inspiration. It becomes pragmatic, and it turns to the pragmatics, as one does in old age, of survival. How am I going to keep my body going? Now I have to do this. I didn't used to have to worry about my heart beating or what breath I was going to have to take next. Now, so then you get economic problems. How are we going to feed people? How are people going to live? And the civilizations tend to become obsessed at the end of their life cycles with practical problems and how to feed populations. It becomes more and more obsessed with money and pragmatism, and it loses touch with the initial religious metaphysical ideas, which are slowly becoming semantically depleted, and which means that they're dying and they're going to go away. But then new ideas then, of course, are going to come into being through what Arnold Toynbee calls internal proletariats. And internal proletariats are these groups where you get like a pocket of disaffected individuals who are in that civilization, but not of it. They're almost like cancerous tumors. They're not playing with the same DNA that the rest of the civilization is, like, let's say, with the early Christians. They're a disaffected group. They have lost faith in what used to be the creative minority when the archai were effective. Now that they're semantically depleted, the creative minority is now a dominant minority, which no longer leads the civilization by mimesis and imitation, people wanting to imitate the elite, but by force, by command. do this or else, as in the case of our current surveillance society, do this or else this is going to happen to you. So then they become disaffected, and then they begin to detach from the body social with a new set of ideas, invariably religious, that then begins to spread. Other people get on board with them, and it slowly becomes like a meme almost. It starts to spread as the mother civilization or the mother body begins to die and disintegrate. Now you've got another civilization coming in as a what Toynbee calls a chrysalis that begins to give birth to something new. And slowly, in the case of Christianity, it comes in and it overcodes and replaces paganism. And the whole Greco-Roman tradition gets overcoded and replaced until by the 4th century AD under Theodosius, as we were talking about earlier, it becomes extinct. That's the way civilizations work. Whether Spengler's model is to be taken literally or not doesn't really matter in theory. In practice, this is what happens, in my experience. This is how it works.
Well, you can even see it with the Enlightenment, right? I mean, you have two opposing sides that come out of the Enlightenment in a way, or reactions to the Enlightenment. I guess on one hand, you have Marx and, you know, later on things like the Frankfurt School. And then on the other hand, you have fascism, you know, which they both sort of exist because of modernity.
Right.
So I sort of see what you're saying there. Yeah.
Yeah, there is a kind of always a kind of Hegelian dialectic there. A reaction, a thesis, then an antithesis, synthesis, then another thesis, antithesis, and so forth. Yeah, that's human beings are never happy, are they? we're never just okay, everything's fine. We never seem to want to sit with that.
Well, I mean, that would kind of be the Faustian individual, maybe, right? I mean, not the indigenous pre-modern. When Heidegger's fourfold was still abided, you know what I mean? Maybe it's a characteristic of our civilization and gadgets and tool making, and you know, to the extent that we've done it.
There's just one more thing I wanted to ask you about, if you have the time.
Sure.
I wanted to ask about you have an entire chapter devoted not only to Trump, but a very interesting movie with Jim Carrey called The Truman Show. And, you know, it's become very apropos in a lot of ways. Maybe you can talk about why you and Brian in the book decided to hone in on that specific movie and what it means in terms of hypermodernity.
Yeah, well, the Truman Show is really interesting. I think it came out like 96, I think. So right as hypermodernity was at its inceptual point. And it envisions this guy, you know, played by Jim Carrey, named Truman, who is raised inside of this bubble, basically a dome that has a fake sun and a fake moon with these fake neighborhoods. And everyone around him is an actor. His wife is an actress pretending to be his wife. He has a pretend best friend. But he doesn't know any of this. So the joke is on him. And he is the first person in history to have been raised from birth live on camera. And so everybody at home on their televisions are watching his life unfold. So you can turn on the Truman Show channel and see where he's at in his life and what's happening to him. So he's encased inside of this dome of technology, which I see as a metaphor for where we're at right now with hyper modernity. We're inside of a technological dome.
The hollow earth.
Yeah, the hollow earth. That has replaced reality. We don't know what's real and what isn't anymore. The media has come in between us and the real. So we're not sure what's outside that dome. The real has disappeared, like Baudrillard used to talk about, into the hyperreal, which is now the realm surrounding us of a media-saturated, mediatized reality that surrounds us and oversaturates us with significations that constantly bombard us with semiotic excess, as Michael was talking about in the early part of the show, which is the essence of hypermodernity. And it does create paranoia because you don't know, did that really happen or was that fake news? Was JFK really assassinated? Was there a conspiracy? I mean, everything becomes a complete paranoia in an age of media oversaturation and overload. And I see Truman's situation with his paranoia as a perfect metaphor for the individual caught inside the dome of a media saturated reality that has replaced an occluded contact with the real. So the oversaturated media world is between the individual and the real, and we can't get to the real. Truman penetrates it at the end of the show with his boat that punctures a hole into it. But we're not even there. I mean, it's so difficult to find out what's real and what isn't, that you do result to pattern recognition. As McLuhan used to say, information, one response to information overload is pattern recognition. And conspiracy theory, on the one hand, is pattern recognition gone awry. Mythology.
Seeing patterns where there aren't necessarily patterns.
Exactly. As with Videodrome, or The Crying of Lot 49. Or, on the other hand, mythology and the creation of myth-making is another form of pattern recognition, which is an attempt to ontologically organize the information into an, what I call an apparatus of semiotic capture that captures the signifiers, puts them in place, and makes sense out of a reality such that the world can become livable within that mandalic reality of semiotic capture. Those are the two responses to information overload. So that's why we talked about the term.
You know, I wanted to get your – well, go ahead, Michael. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I just – what was kind of cool about that, John, is that Truman's reality does have a conspiracy behind it. You know what I'm saying? Like, and
– yeah, in his case, there is a conspiracy. Yeah. Right, yeah.
And you know what that makes me think about is that, you know, in our time right now, where conspiracy theories proliferate on the internet and people – you know, get really hooked into them in a lot of different ways. It's almost like because we're on the internet and everything is so hyper-mediated now, there actually are agents behind all these different media. You know, there are corporations and algorithms that are like conspiracies, you know, that run and manage the things behind the scenes. And so it's almost like this conspiracy culture, you know, that's been augmented, you know, in recent years, is sort of like an intuition of that, like that there are these invisible agents behind things, and that's because we're all online all the time. We're all, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, we're always plugged in. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing I wanted to ask John about. You know, in the Truman Show, I found Carrie's character interesting, but I also found the Ed Harris character, who's the architect of the show, very interesting. What do you think the Ed Harris character in that movie sort of represents in terms of hypermodernity?
Well, I mean, you can look at him from a number of different angles. From one point of view, he's like the Rupert Murdoch or the Ted Turner, the guy behind the scenes of our hypermodern world, who, you know, is at the control panel, pulling all, you know, calling all the shots and dictating to us what our reality is going to be. But on the other hand, there's an older ontological layer behind that where he's a stand-in for God or the gods. I like to think of the scene where they're manufacturing a storm for Truman so that he won't discover the true reality. It reminded me of a scene in The Odyssey where the gods call forth a storm specifically to shift because they want to get Odysseus somewhere. I forget where he's going, but they want to shift him somewhere. So the gods, you know, they're keeping an eye on him just as the Ed Harris character and his crew are keeping an eye on Truman. So he's kind of a stand-in, a modern technological equivalent for the gods. And so what does that say about guys like Ted Turner and Rupert Murdoch and these you know, Howard Hughes, and these weak stand-ins now who manage what we call reality, which used to be done for us by the gods and are now done for us by these very weak stand-ins for what used to be the gods. It's kind of depressing, actually.
Yeah, they sort of filled the semiotic vacancy.
Yeah, exactly, right.
The death of God, yeah.
Well, there's also a sort of ambiguity to his character, because I think he's a very
he's
a very authoritarian character, but you can also make the argument that he cares for Jim Carrey maybe in the wrong way. Like, I think I think he wants to protect Jim Carrey from reality, or at least that's one interpretation of him.
Sure, that works. Yeah, that's the great thing about good art is that it's full of ambiguities and there's no way of ever nailing it down. That's why we're still talking about Dante, Shakespeare, and Goethe, Euripides, those guys, because you can never nail it down. So it just means this, and that's all it is. It's like a math equation or something. You know, art doesn't work that way. It works on multiple levels, and that's why it's so wonderful.
Well, I was going to add to, and then I'll wrap up here, is I always found it interesting that the Truman Show, there's actually now a thing called the Truman Show delusion, where people actually think you know, there are people out there that come to believe that they are in a reality show, a staged reality show.
And it's I believe that.
The Truman Show delusion, yeah.
That is no surprise to me at all.
That's hyper-modernity on steroids, folks.
It is.
It's kind of like the Mandela effect, too, you know, where there are people who believe that there's a conspiracy that history has been retroactively changed, and that rather than your memory just being wrong, there are people who believe that the history was actually altered somehow, and they remember the actual timeline, you know, or before it was altered. And it's called the Mandela effect, because a lot of people believe that Nelson Mandela died in prison, and I think it was in the 1980s. But that's not true. He died, more recently than that. And so I don't know if you guys heard about the Mandela effect.
I'm familiar with the
Mandela effect, and also the Berenstain Bears.
Yeah, well, that's what they say it is, because it turns out that we all thought it was the Berenstain Bears, and that's actually how I remember it too, that it was Berenstain Bears. But it's not. It's Berenstain Bears. The way it's spelled is not S-T, would it be I-E-N, or it's actually S-T-I-A-N. And people swear that it was Berenstain, not Berenstain or Stain, or, you know. I remember it that way, too. So, I mean, I'm kind of I fall into the Mandela effect as well, because that's how I remember it. And so it's part of this weird hyper-modern environment where there are these sort of conspiracy theories and beliefs about time being altered and multiple realities. And all of these things proliferate through the internet. You know what I mean? The Mandela effect is something, you know, you can Google it and, you know, or look it up on Reddit, and you'll see all kinds of, all kinds of information about it, and people reporting, you know, things that have been, they believe are retroactively changed. But it's like that Truman delusion, right? I mean, it's, you know, memory is faulty. We all know that. I mean, that's psychology 101, that, you know, people are not good rememberers, you know. So if that's the more likely possibility, then there's some conspiracy to change reality. But who knows? You know, I mean, anything's possible, right?
Yeah, right.
It's interesting because lately I've had a few shows I've done on the Jeffrey Epstein case, and within the past week I've told people, after this I want to get away from anything that is like conspiracy theory related. But it seems like no matter what I do, conspiracy theory now comes up in the topic, whether it's for or against. It has a way of just invading conversations now, and I think that's also an indicator of the times, a sign of the times, if you will.
That's that semiotic excess, you know, that it just comes up in conspiracy theories and in multiple realities, and it's that whole thing, you know.
Even when you're not trying to bring it up, it will come up. I've told people that. They're like, why does it come up so often? I'm like, I don't know. It just sort of does.
Semiotic excess. That's perfect.
Well, I guess in closing, John and Michael, maybe you can tell my listeners where they can find your work, and just, you know, any positive vibes you can leave my listeners with, because I always like to end on a positive note here, but that's becoming harder and harder these days.
Michael?
Sure. So you can find me on Amazon.com. I've got my first book of poetry, or published book of poetry, on there, which is called Absences. And I recommend checking it out. In some ways, I kind of see it, or we kind of see it as instrumental to this idea of hypermodernity, in a sense that it was an attempt to, not necessarily consciously, but it was an attempt to capture this hypermodern landscape in language. And once something can enter into language, then it becomes real, in a sense. You know what I mean? So that book makes this attempt to do that. And John David Ebert wrote the afterword to it, which is fucking awesome. So for that alone, you should check it out and read the whole thing. I also am going to have a new book out, which is the follow-up to Absences. I'm looking at September as being the date of release. I have someone designing it right now, the cover and the layout and all that kind of stuff. So that should be out, and it will be out on Amazon as well, hopefully in September. It's called Clouds. And I talked about, you know, the icon of the cloud earlier. And so this is a whole poetry cycle that sort of gets into the depths of that idea, I guess, in a poetical fashion. And then I'm also on Twitter, Michael Aaron K. I'm not a great Twitter user, I guess, but I try. And I'm also on medium.com, Michael Aaron Kamens. There's some good samples of my poetry on there to check out, and some very preliminary notes on this hypermodernity idea that we've been talking about, and stuff like that on there. So, yeah, and I'll leave it with that. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, and so my stuff is all I have. I think I'm up to 700 videos now on YouTube. So I'm all over YouTube. Just type in my name, and all kinds of stuff will come up. Pretty much on.
Have they put you on Wikipedia yet?
I don't think so.
They need to get around to that. You've written 25 books, and they won't put you on Wikipedia. That's BS.
Yeah, I know they have some kind of weird bias against me. I'm not sure what's wrong with them. But, yeah, so I'm all over YouTube. And then, of course, I have 26 books on Amazon. The newest one is, of course, Hypermodernity and the End of the World, which I've co-authored with Brian Francis Culkin. Michael wrote the preface for it. So there's that. You can order that on there. And that, by the way, is the first of a trilogy. We're planning two more hypermodernity books to follow that. So there will be two more. And then I also have a Patreon account for anyone interested in donating. I also have that. And so that's pretty much it. Those are the three places where people can reach me. And I'm also on Facebook if you want to friend me. I'm there, too. And I'm also on Twitter as well.
Well, hey, I want to thank you both again for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, thank you for having us,
yeah,
JG.
Thank you. Thanks, JG.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic conversation. I loved every minute of it. It was great.
Well, that does it for this jam-packed edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with media theorist John David Ebert and, of course, poet Michael Kamens on John's book, co-authored with Brian Francis Culkin, Hypermodernity and the End of the World. In other news, as the spooky season of Halloween gets underway, I just made an appearance on the Horror Vanguard podcast, talking about the most maligned entry in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise, Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation. Part one of that two-hour conversation is now available on Horror Vanguard's SoundCloud, their main feed. You can give it a listen. I think it will rev you up for the spooky season. And by the way, when it comes to the spooky season of Halloween, I just got done doing an interview only hours ago with Vanita Estella. Not familiar with that name? Well, she is a member of the Satanic Temple, a stripper, model, and dominatrix. And, get this, a campaigner and supporter for Bernie Sanders. So, you should be expecting that episode to come out in, I would say, early October. Possibly the first week, maybe the second at latest. So, we're getting into the spooky season groove here on Parallax Views. Also, a note, we have a new show for Parallax Views patrons, The Week That Was with my buddy Casey, where we will cover the news stories and culture wars that have gone down the memory hole in the past week. Check that out as soon as you can. Lots cooking. with Parallax Views as we get into the Halloween time fever. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.